Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
On a mixtape just around the corner, did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like song, and my song's gonna break.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. My name is Mark Hamilton, and joining me today, my friend, my neighbor, my enemy, my op, Mr. Daly. And Mr. Daly, boy, do I have a Coquitlam story for you. So obviously knows we live in the sunny, I was going to say sunny, but the very cloudy, wet suburb of Vancouver called Coquitlam. So last night, dude, it was Halloween and yep. I'm sitting at the dining table doing some work on my corporate laptop because I did have a great, hugely productive day. So I'm like, I kind of feel like I owe it, but I'm sitting there and I'm like, we haven't had a single kid come trick-or-treating. So my wife had taken my son out with some of their friends and I stayed home, but I heard some rustling outside. I'm just like, this rustling has been going on for a very long time. Like, why are these kids not ringing the doorbell? So I'm like, I'm just going to go and open the door. And I open the door, dude, and there's a gigantic black bear, literally 40 inches from my face, going through my garbage. I'm like, not, and it happens way too often because I always forget to lock our garbage bins, which is something you just have to do here. So I slam the door and I go to grab my phone and I come out and the giant bear is dragging our garbage bag up the street, like just spilling garbage everywhere. So I screamed at him to take off. And then of course, spent a good half an hour cleaning up the mess, but just a good reminder, man, that our community is literally carved out of the side of a rainforest. Dude, how are you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm good. I have a similar story because there was this viral video that went around this past summer of this bear stealing a golfer's golf bag off the golf cart at Westwood Plateau.
Was that where it was? I saw that.
Yeah, so that is literally like just on the other side of the little like green belt where my house is. I'm like, that's the same blanking bear that like tears through my garbage every Friday morning. That time he just went after that guy's golf bag because he probably had a ham sandwich in there.
Yeah, or something
like that. And then because you saw like the bear took it off the back of the golf cart, dragged into a ravine, and then he never saw his clubs again.
That's crazy hilarious stuff, man.
Dude, yeah.
And for those of you that are maybe a little shocked that we're being so casual about the bears, the black bears aren't the problem. They eat fish and berries and garbage. It's the cougars which populate the hills of our community that you need to be a little bit more kind of conscious of.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a little bit of PSA is just, don't feed the bears garbage, I guess, is the moral of that story.
Or lock your garbage. Don't encourage them. So, dude, a couple of things. One, we always kind of do this great shout out to Magnus in the race weekend. So I had a conversation with Magnus today. Of course, he's very excited because his Philadelphia 76ers have exited James Harden. But he and I were talking about Formula One.
Magnus is always excited. He's like the most positive person I think I've known and met in a long time. Anyways,
I totally agree. But he is working on, and I'm not going to share the details because I don't know that I'm privy to, but the upcoming issue of Race Weekend magazine is going to be an all-timer. And as I understand it, it's going to drop shortly before the Las Vegas Grand Prix, but it's an all-timer. And if that's not a good enough tease for you to drop by the Race Weekend website and kind of order yourself up a subscription, I don't know what would be, but he kind of gave me some of the details. But again, like I said, I don't know if I should be sharing them on the air quite yet, but it's going to be an all-timer magazine. That's for sure.
Cool. Well, that is a horrible tease. But anyways, like you said, go check them out, theraceweekend.com, RACEWKND.com. If you decide to get a subscription, enter in our promo code ScuderiaPod at checkout, receive 10% off. Also, head on over to RacingExclusives.com. They've provided this beautiful, gorgeous 1/2 scale Max Verstappen helmet autographed by the now 3-time world champion. And we're going to give that away in just a couple of weeks. Comes with the COA, as does all their merch. So you know where it came from and it's totally legit. And Excuse me. And you can find them at racingexclusives.com. So just a quick championship update after the Mexican Grand Prix this past weekend, or the Mexico City Grand Prix. Max Verstappen, 491 points. Sergio Perez, 240. Lewis Hamilton, 220. Carlos Sainz, 183. Fernando Alonso, also 183 points. And then Lando Norris kind of knocking on the door of the top five. He has 169 points. Over in the constructors, we have 731 points for Red Bull, 371 for Mercedes, 349 for Ferrari, 256 for McLaren, which I think they scored entirely since the beginning of July. It's been incredible. And then fifth, you have Aston Martin with a 236. And obviously, Max has wrapped up the World Drivers' Championship. Red Bull have won the Constructors' Championship. So why are we even here? But we still have, what, three races left. So that's why we're talking about bears getting into our garbage. Because our garbage recycling pickup might actually be a little bit more exciting than what's happening in Formula One. But that
I'm timing
is just
the garbage truck as it comes down the street. What does that stop look like? 4 seconds.
Yes, what was that? He's up. His Delta. He's ahead of schedule this week. He's going to set a fastest lap. Yeah. That's just how sad we are, Mark.
Oh yeah.
Anyways,
oh my gosh.
Do you have the fantasy?
I do. Just a reminder of the prize is, of course, the racing exclusives provided 1/2 scale. Max Verstappen championship helmet that is also signed with a certificate of authenticity. This weekend, I actually dug out the helmet because to be totally honest, man, I put it away and I forgot where it was. So I had a bit of a panic this weekend trying to find it, but I found it at the bottom of a closet. So it is bubble wrapped, it is boxed, and it is paired with the certificate of authenticity. So like you said, three races, and we're going to know who the winner is, and that's going to be in the mail. So if you are in the top 10, the top 15, continue to pay attention. And if you are the race winner, I don't know how to associate the teams on the list with an individual. So what I will ask the race winner or the championship winner to do is reach out to us, send us an email, just send us a screenshot of your team profile on the F1 website as kind of proof that that's you. And then we'll make arrangements to ship it to you via UPS or FedEx or whatever it is. Hopefully shipping is not going to be crazy, but again, we're obligated to do this. So we'll make sure we get it to you. But in terms of who's leading the championship right now, Michael Cronje, 16 on 5,843 points. Following in number two up to spot number two, Vernal Mpago, Marquin Hoss, 5,809 points. Number three, Zenata Team 3, followed by Axis Simon, Vince Dest 3, Matt Noob Team 3, Bengals Bubs, who I actually just messaged earlier today, Matt Noob Team 2, Aaron Kiernalinen, I still can't get that, Zenata Team 1, USAP 2, Joel's 1, McLarlando, Yellow Racing, Matt Noob Team 1, and finally in the 16th spot, I'll just arbitrarily stop there, Vince Dest 1. But I think my point is, if you look at the top three teams right now, they're only separated by 40 points. And when you're talking about accumulating hundreds of points per race weekend, it's still wide open. And of course, this weekend, unfortunately, is a sprint race weekend, which I'd completely forgotten. And I was devastated to see when I was pulling up the race preview for this weekend. So tons and tons of points still available. This thing is wide open, baby. Wide open.
Yeah, exciting, exciting. And you never mentioned right off of the top that you never let me get my hands on the prize that we're going to give away, because you just knew that if it got out of your sight even for half a second, I just would never have taken it or given it back. So you did the right thing by burying it in a closet and keeping it safely away from me.
And dude, don't forget, Thies also gave us a signed Pierre Gasly helmet, which presumably we can use for the Fantasy League next year if you and I are still together doing this show. But we've got next year's prize lined up already as well.
Are you threatening to break up? Are you threatening to go solo or something like that? Well, you know, you never know what happens.
it's podcasts are a lot of work, man. And you know, it's funny, like when you were away on your mystery trip for the 3 or 4 months it was from April till October 15th, it's a lot of work. The only benefit of recording by yourself is you can pause and take a break. So like a couple of times when I was recording, like, you know what, I didn't like that, I'm gonna pause, delete, do that again. But it also makes the episode really choppy, and when you go back and notice it, you can see like, I stopped here and I stopped here and I took a break here. So I prefer our approach, our free flowing, as you say, direct to tape or whatever your expression is. Like, I like this approach. It might not be perfect, but it's more organic and authentic. I like the dual approach.
it's kind of nice because you can only talk so much and then you kind of like hand it off to, I hand it off to you or vice versa. And then that person rambles on for another minute. And that's why we have like 90 minute episodes here that could like probably be wrapped up in 15 minutes if we were actually professional about all this.
Exactly. Exactly.
Anyways, before we get into the show itself, just another quick reminder, the our watch party coming up at your place in, what, 2 weeks now? Can you believe November?
2 weeks?
Well, yeah, yeah. Scary, right?
By the way, big shout out to you because the last two race weekends, I didn't actually get to see the race until much, much later because I've been talking about this. Like, I've torn my house apart because all I wanted, and I'll be totally honest, the whole point of this race watch party, it was a giant con job to convince my wife to get a new TV. But getting a new TV meant taking out our existing wall-mounted stand and some wall cladding, which meant a ton of drywall work and painting, which meant painting multiple walls, which meant painting multiple baseboards, which means, well, I should probably touch up all these other damaged areas throughout the house. And then it meant new electrical work. And it just kept growing and growing. And then new furniture purchases and new, like, it's become a massive thing. So thank you to you for stepping in and letting me focus on the house the last two weekends. So everything is done. My good friend, Mr. Gil Gamboa, has been providing a lot of guidance with respect to kind of the home theater, kind of the technical side, which I'm totally not capable of doing. So big shout out to Gil, who, of course, I used to co-host the Flash F1 podcast back in the day. And he'll also hopefully be at the watch party as well, which I'm super excited about. But yeah, again, 2 weeks, just a little over 2 weeks, man. Like at one point it was 80 days, 50 days, 30 days. Now we're sitting here. We're basically, I think, 17 days out. So Saturday, November the 18th, fully catered. We'll have food, we'll have drink. If you plan to drink, make sure to make arrangements for Uber or have a friend drop you off or pick you up or come with somebody that's going to be a designated driver. We want to make sure that everyone's super responsible. And again, the only thing we're going to ask is that you make a $30 donation to the Canadian Mental Health Association, which I think is an organization that is near and dear to both of us. But yeah, 17 days away, man. 17 days. It's crazy.
Yeah, I still can't believe that we just hit the 1st of November today. And it was kind of funny, too, because I noticed when I went picked up the mail today, there were all these flyers full of like Christmas things.
You got the Toys R Us one. I'm sure you got that one.
Yeah, we got that one, too, because the kids are going over that right now. Yeah. So they're circling all the things that they're not going to get for Christmas, and they'll be disappointed come the big day. But
you're such a bad dad, man. But that's also the byproduct of having 17 kids, right? Like your dollar has to go that much farther.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's just, you know, times are tough, my friend. Anyways, times aren't tough if you like other things Formula One related, because Braun, the Impossible F1 Story, hosted by Mr. Keanu Reeves, the trailer is now live on Disney Plus. I haven't had a chance to check it out, Mark.
It's
Did
good.
You get a chance
so
to see it? Is it good?
So I don't know if it, I don't know where it's going to be airing in the US, but in Canada and the UK, it's going to be on Disney Plus. So Disney Plus, despite the fact that our federal finance minister said, hey, the medication for all your financial, I don't know if people heard this, but some time ago, our finance minister, I'm going super political here, made a comment that if people are having financial struggles in Canada, they should cancel their Disney Plus subscription. But I'm not canceling it because we use it a lot. But it's going to be on Disney Plus in the UK and Canada, I think maybe Hulu in the US. But it's this phenomenal documentary that's being spearheaded by Keanu Reeves, and it dives into the 2009 Cinderella Braun series. The trailer looks really good, and Keanu Reeves is awesome, and his passion for F1 really comes out, really shines through in this trailer. Side note, on the plane recently, I saw John Wick 4, which is amazing. Everyone has to see that. It sounds fantastic. It's really cool. But anyways, the documentary is awesome, and it's going to be dropping, I guess, at some point before the end of the year. Make sure you check out the trailer because it'll get you excited. And I know a lot of our listeners weren't watching F1 in 2009. This is a great way to revisit what was one of the most magical seasons in the history of the sport.
Yeah, yeah. I can't wait to see this series as soon as it goes live here, which, you know, comes right at the perfect time of year for me when things kind of tail off at the end of the year. Okay, so before we start talking about Danny Ricciardo and Sergio Perez, because we're going to talk about that a lot, Chris Medland had an interesting tweet and said, quote, been doing a little bit of maths for a feature, and over the past five race weekends, Lewis Hamilton has outscored Sergio Perez by an average of 7 points per weekend. Maintained that rate over the final three, and he pipped Checo to second place by 1 point. That is really kind of interesting. Like that we're having that conversation now that this could actually happen, that Lewis could overtake Sergio Perez for second in the Drivers' Championship. I mean, obviously he wants to win. Mercedes wants to win the Drivers' and the Constructors' Championship. But if he could actually do that, wouldn't that be a huge W for Mercedes considering where they've been over the past almost 2 years, last year, right off this year, you know, changed philosophy, like all way, you know, while the season was going on. So to recover from that to a second in the Drivers' Championship, I think would be a huge moral victory for them. Anyways, thought that was kind of a cool stat.
Yeah, I've got some comments about Lewis, but I'll save those for a little later in the show because we've got another story about Hamilton and Mercedes and putting together a car that could potentially compete with Red Bull next year. But we can circle back on that one in a little bit.
Yeah, so why do we get into the fun part, the conversation? Maybe it's more fun if you're a Danny Ricciardo fan compared to if you're a Checo fan, but still, this first article comes from F1.com, written by Philip Clearin, entitled Outstanding Ricciardo Looked His Old Self in Mexico GP. And there's some really good quotes in here from Christian Horner, the Red Bull team principal. First one is, quote, "It's great to see Daniel performing so well, and it fully endorses the reason why we brought him back into AlphaTauri just prior to the summer break. I thought he was outstanding this weekend, fighting Mercedes in an AlphaTauri. Had it been not for the red flag, he probably would have finished further up. A great performance from him, and certainly it looked like the Daniel of old," end quote. So shall we just jump into this, Mark? You know, that Sergio Perez, had he made that move on the outside of turn one, on lap one of the Mexico City Grand Prix, if he pulled that off, he would have looked like a rock star. Unfortunately, you can't get three cars into one in that one corner. Sergio and Charles Leclerc came together. Sergio went airborne and retired shortly thereafter. And then Charles went on to finish the race, finished on the podium, of course. But it's just another one of those incidents, right? I mean, let me ask you this, Mark. If you're Sergio Perez, you are where you are in the championship. Max has got the championship wrapped up for the drivers, so you don't need to run cover for him, be his wingman. You don't have to worry about Red Bull not winning the Constructors' Championship. All those things are now taken care of. So now it's your one opportunity to make a name for yourself at your home Grand Prix, where tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of your countrymen have shown up to support you. Are you doing the same thing Sergio did?
No. I don't think I do. And I think this isn't a criticism of Sergio Perez, because he made obviously some comments post-race that said, look, you know what, if I wanted to contend for a race win, I needed to make that move at that exact moment, or that opportunity was going to get away from me for a variety of different reasons. But I think the risk, and it's always got to be a calculated decision, right? And he had to have been thinking about this pre-race. That I don't think that was a decision he made in the moment. I think his thought was, if I catch a slipstream and I'm in a position to overtake, I'm going to make the effort to do it. I just think that the risk versus reward is so low here that even if he manages to squeeze by the Ferraris, he's never going to catch his teammate. That maybe best luck he finishes on the podium in a P2 or a P3, and maybe that's a good outcome. But the offset is, hey, you don't make this super risky move and you still finish well within the points, and you come home and you cross the finish line and people cheer for you. And that's a good outcome. It's just to make that maneuver and to assume that risk and to take that risk and then kind of have to deal with the fallout of that is terrible. And it's not like he's in a position where he's comfortably P2 in the championship by 100 points, which is probably where he should be. We know, as per that comment from Chris Medlin a couple of minutes ago, that Lewis has every opportunity to pass him in the championship. And I think if Lewis hadn't been disqualified in COTA because of the issue with the thickness of the plank, which again was a Mercedes issue, although I'm sure many other teams would have suffered the same fate if they were tested. But I think it's a very risky move. And ultimately, I think maybe part of this is because he maybe knows some things that we don't, that maybe the decision's already been made, that he's not going to be back. And maybe he's thinking like, hey, there's an opportunity here for me to have a to go with a bang, to go with a flash at my home Grand Prix, that maybe he's thinking this is my last opportunity to race in front of my home fans, and I'm gonna take that risk. So again, it's not a criticism, but I wouldn't have done it. I would have just said, hey, you know what? I have the opportunity to finish P3, P4, P5, score a bunch of points and cross the finish line, or alternatively, it's gonna be the super risky move and I'm gonna DNF and I'm gonna be out, and maybe my season and my career is officially over. But now he's in this super tenuous position where he only sits 20 points ahead of Lewis in the championship, and there's three races left, and Lewis has every opportunity to pass him, which is terrifying.
Well, I'm just looking at the season stats here right now. So he started the season not too bad. He had the first five races of the year from Bahrain through to Miami. He had two wins in Saudi and Azerbaijan, two P2s in Bahrain and Miami, then a P5 in Australia, then have that forgettable weekend in Monaco, ends up finishing 16th. And then you have that long run between Spain all the way up to Singapore. During that point, he had a couple of podium finishes. He had two threes and two P2s, and then finished a couple of P6s, a couple of P4s, a P8 in Singapore. They get to Japan, he retires from that one. 10th in Qatar, 4th at COTA a couple of weeks ago, and then retired obviously on the first lap of the Mexico City Grand Prix last week. But I mean, since Singapore, I mean, his best result is a 4th. You know, when you look at the same time, like Max finished 5th in Singapore, and then has rattled off 4 consecutive wins in Japan, Qatar, USA, and Mexico. And I mean, Max has had obviously an outstanding year. Like 5th is the worst result that he had, and other than 5th, the only his two other worst results, and I'm using the inverted commas here, was a P2 in Saudi and a P2 in Azerbaijan, which were the races that that Sergio made, or sorry, that won. But I get the point that you're making, Mark, that Sergio is kind of in this really slippery position. He should be comfortably ahead. We should be having this conversation that he could be pipped by Lewis Hamilton to second place in the Drivers' Championship. And it'd be interesting too, like if we kind of did the math and see how many points that he left on the table here. I mean, yeah, it could easily be 100 points, but I don't know. I'm not really sure he knows something that we don't know, but maybe he's got like a good suspicion. Maybe they had some sort of discussion internally that, hey, we're going to go with you for 2024, but these are the things that we're going to have to see. Maybe they sent some sort of benchmark for him over the last, I don't know, 5 races a season, their second half of the season or something like that, because even all those other results, right? I mean, like after like Miami or after Monaco, I mean, he becomes like a little bit like erratic. I mean, like 4ths and 6ths and a 10th in Qatar and stuff like that. I mean, and the thing is, with them, they got the car, right? Everybody wants to have a Red Bull. Everybody wants to be in that car because everybody knows how good it is, and this is a championship winning car. But, he's not been consistent, say, as Valtteri Bottas was at Mercedes, right, Mark? What do you think about that?
Yeah.
You're grimacing.
No. I'm just compiling my thoughts. I think the challenge for Sergio Perez, and I think where things started to go off the rails this year, was qualifying. And ultimately, you just kind of ran off a bunch of the poor results in the back half of the season, or maybe the kind of the final act, as you might call it. But I think a big byproduct or a big kind of manifestation, or I would say trigger or catalyst for these results, was the fact that he's just struggling so badly in qualifying trim, that he's going out there and he's really competing against nobody but himself. And in a lot of cases, he wasn't getting out of Q1 or Q2, and he was struggling to get to Q3. And in doing so, despite the fact that he's got the best car in the grid, the minute you qualify P5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all of a sudden you've got 6, 7, 8 cars in front of you. So when that light turns green, all of a sudden, or the lights go out, all of a sudden you have to fight all of these other cars, and you make life so much more difficult for you, that really the gift of having a car like the RB19 is, I should be able to qualify clear of everyone else so that when the lights go out, I'm in clean air and the only person I'm competing with is my teammate. And because he couldn't qualify well, he would put himself at this massive disadvantage every single time. And then once he's caught up in traffic, he started making all of these unforced errors. And as a result, he would struggle even more. And there was some bad luck and some things that didn't go necessarily his way. But the single biggest issue is purely Sergio Perez not being able to qualify effectively. And if you look at his qualifying performances over the course of the season, especially as we get into this final act, they just crater. And I think we had conversations about the frequency with which he couldn't get out of Q2 and the frequency with which he was in some cases not getting out of Q1, that's just absolutely unacceptable given that car and given the fact that in qualifying, like I said, you're competing really against nobody but yourself. And I think that's where the downfall of his season came. And people can argue, oh, well, the car is built for Max Verstappen. It's his driving style. It's his driving style. But Sergio Perez isn't a young driver. And I get that the sense I get is that, you know, Max likes to go deep and rotate the car and that Sergio takes kind of a slower, more square or U-shaped turn into corners. But ultimately, he's had a couple of years now to adapt his driving style. And if you look at the first four or five races of the season where he had two race wins and two second place finishes, he clearly knows how to maneuver this car. But something went wrong, and it was either that the development of the car went in a direction that he wasn't comfortable with, or maybe he's battling himself and it's become a psychological nightmare for him on the track. But ultimately, I think at this point, I would be not shocked, I would be stunned if he came back. And you know, you and I were messaging on Sunday about this, that ultimately the race weekend couldn't have been worse for Sergio Perez in terms of securing his seat for next year. And I know he's got a contract, but again, that doesn't mean anything. And it couldn't have been better for Daniel Ricciardo. And I was reading something a couple of days ago that made a lot of sense. And it was that, look, Daniel Ricciardo's performance on the weekend, looked maybe better than it was, and that he's being partnered with a really great car right now, that the development of the AT04 has come a long way. But at the same time, all of the credit for the development of the AT04 since Zandvoort, and even before Zandvoort, is on Daniel Ricciardo, that as soon as he got paired with the AlphaTauri team and he started providing input to his race engineer, and that was trickling down to the factory, all of a sudden the team was getting this massive stream of ultra valuable feedback from an established, accomplished driver that knows what he's talking about. And all of a sudden, all of the decisions that they were making with respect to the setup of the suspension and the aerodynamic surface and all those kind of pieces, all of a sudden, all of their decisions were being informed by this really great feedback. So suddenly you've got Daniel Ricciardo in this car, who is significantly better as a driver than Nyck de Vries or Yuki Tsunoda. And number two, all of a sudden their development is being fast-tracked because they're getting better feedback from an accomplished driver. So one, the car he's in now is significantly better than the AT04 was earlier in the season. But two, he's just the best driver that they've had in a couple of years. So all of a sudden this kind of combination of driver and improved car is manifesting itself in really great qualifying performances. Like, he qualified P4. What the heck? He qualified P4 in Mexico and finished P7 in the race. That's fantastic. And all of a sudden, you have to think that Daniel Ricciardo is going to be in the Red Bull next year. And there was some really great articles this week that kind of talked about the fact that, look, Daniel Ricciardo really struggled at McLaren, and we all know. And I think that there's a lot of reasons for that. And Daniel Ricciardo has a very specific driving style that a lot of drivers like to go really deep into a corner and they brake really hard. And then they have a very slow technical rotation of the car. And it's almost like a V-shaped turn. And that's what the McLaren was good at doing. And Daniel Ricciardo's driving style is, you know what? He prefers a slower approach, braking a little bit earlier, but he likes to rotate more gradually through the corner. And that's his driving style. And the AT04 is very compatible with that driving style. And presumably so too is the RB19 and its successor, the RB20, but he's just in a really great place. We're seeing the old Daniel Ricciardo. I think all of the comments that you're hearing, especially from people like Christian Horner, are very, very, very genuine. But I have to think at this point that, and I was talking to my buddy Randy about this a couple of days ago, and he was making this great comment that if you're Red Bull, you know what, forget what you owe Sergio Perez. You're accountable to the owners of the team, and you're also accountable to the sponsors that are pumping tens of millions of dollars into that team, and they expect to see not one, but two drivers competing for race wins. They're not signing up and cutting checks for $5, $10, $15, $20 million a year to see one of the drivers in the best car in the world finishing P5, 6, 7, 8 every single race and struggle in the midfield. That's not what they're signing up for. And ultimately, if Christian Horner doesn't make the decision to swap those drivers, I think his hand's going to be forced because the sponsors are going to put pressure on him to make that swap. And again, Daniel Ricciardo, by the way, is the marketer's dream. Like, as a salesperson, if you're out there selling sponsorship and you have Daniel Ricciardo on your team, like, he's just absolutely gold and he makes that conversation so much easier. But just a remarkably bad weekend for Sergio Perez, regardless of the fact that it was his home Grand Prix, and just a phenomenal result for Daniel Ricciardo. And I think Christian Horner's probably now seen enough that regardless of what happens in the final three races, I think he's probably seen everything he needs to see to make a decision for next year.
Well, you know, you make a really, really good point, right? It's just like how much do you need, like, in terms of, you know, like looking over the pros versus the cons of where you're deciding who's going to be your partner for Max Verstappen. And I mean, like, not only is he giving the team that great feedback to develop this car, which, you know, I think politely put, you know, handled about as good as a sack of hammers at the beginning of the season, and then Ricciardo comes in halfway through the year and he has a couple of races in and around the summer break either side, then he has that crash in Holland at Zandvoort that keeps him out of the car for several races, and he comes back and, you know, second race back he does this, you know, puts the car like in qualifying onto P4, you know, on the second row of the grid. It's like, come on, who does that? And then, like you say, brings it home not just in the top 10 but a very solid top 10 finish. Who knows if that safety car didn't happen because of the result that Kevin Magnussen shunt literally at the halfway point of the race, who knows where he could have ended up. But I think that it was an exciting result for him, obviously, and anybody that's cheering for him, but AlphaTauri as well. Like his team, you must be feeling somewhat justified or validated, I guess, that the car wasn't as bad as we thought, but they just didn't have the people to do it. Because Yuki, let's be fair, I mean, I still think he's like a diamond in the rough. I mean, my question is, how long do they want to take to develop him and see if he can reach the potential that they think that he can reach? And then Nyck de Vries obviously was a disappointment, despite being, what was it, 27, 28 years old. You would have thought he would have brought like a lot more to the team. Maybe he did. And we just don't hear about some of these like lesser visible stories. Like we hear about like Ricciardo, just with all the feedback that he's giving to the team on setup and all these different things. Right. So I don't know. I think the case kind of, you know, sadly for Checo, it kind of sadly works against him at this point. And whether or not they decide to pull the plug sooner or later, that remains the question, if they feel so inclined to do so, because they're not racking up and dominating the sport like Mercedes did, because there was always Nico and always Lewis and always Valtteri Bottas, who was ever in that car from 2014 onwards. It was just guaranteed that you were going to have at least one Mercedes on the podium, usually two, and there were not very many instances when you saw like one on their own, or heaven forbid, two of them off the podium, because it's like they either won everything and ended up second and third, or they didn't do anything at all. And there weren't too many instances of like catastrophic mechanical failures. There were obvious some self-inflicted DNFs and incidents, as you know, if we go back and talk about the Rosberg Hamilton era, etc. But I don't know, just but Ricciardo, like when you look at him, he just looks in a much better place. We'll talk about that. We're way late for a break. We'll do that, come back in a moment, so don't go away. We will be back after a short message from our sponsors, so don't go away. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style,
eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, welcome back to the show. Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton here. We're talking about Danny Ricciardo and Sergio Perez. But just before the break, I'd mentioned that Danny Ricciardo just looks in a better place. Don't you think? Isn't the vibe that you're getting like from Danny Ricciardo like 180 degrees opposite to this time last year when it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that had they announced Piastri by this point in the season? I think they probably did, right? It was in the fall sometime. So, I mean, it was just kind of, you know, like you were just waiting for the ball to drop on that one because, you know, it just hadn't worked despite almost two full seasons with McLaren for all the, you know, the right things that you mentioned before the break, Mark. But it really seems to be that Ricciardo seems like the Ricciardo of old, like sort of pre-2018, because I think that when he left Red Bull at the end of the 2018 season, I think there was frustration there. I kind of picked that vibe up that, you know, at that point, it was pretty obvious that they were going to build this team and this car around Max. And Ricciardo, I think at that point realized, well, obviously he realized that that his destiny laid somewhere else. But, you know, that top seat just wasn't open for him, and say at a Mercedes or Ferrari or anyone like that. So he ends up going to a middle of the grid kind of team with Renault. That doesn't really work out. I mean, he had a couple of podiums at the end there of his stint with Renault, then moves over to McLaren. And we had some flashes of things, right? And I mean, it in the long run, it just didn't pan out the way that that he really wanted. But then come back to, you know, to Red Bull. We talked about it at the time, right? That we thought, you know, both you and I, that Ricciardo, by going back to Red Bull, even as a reserve driver, just seemed like a good move for him. What do you think?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. There you go. So nothing further to add on that one. But, you know, like, but seriously, yeah, though, I mean, he did, it seemed like a much better for him personally, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think obviously, I think the car was better and I think the environment was better. And I think there was some familiarity there. And I don't think that the hunger was ever gone, but I think sometimes to have some time away from the paddock and to be able to focus on yourself and to be able to focus on sim work is something that is probably something that's very, very valuable to a driver that was kind of in his current mind state.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And I guess Where do you think, like, you know, so a couple people have been asking me this all week, and well, for a little while, and just like, what do you think Red Bull is going to do with Ricciardo and Perez? And I really don't think that there's any way to call it. We know that they have a history of literally making changes to driver lineups at the
least publicly it's looks Ricciardo. Like it has to be Ricciardo. It has to be. I think he's shown enough, and I think Sergio's shown enough that they can't come back next year. They could because they know they can slot Ricciardo in very quickly because he's got all the sim work, and they know they can slot Liam Lawson into the AlphaTauri. But I just think it would be incredibly valuable to give Daniel Ricciardo the winter, knowing that psychologically I'm going to be driving for the Milton Keynes based team. And then you give Liam Lawson the winter to psychologically prepare to come in as a full-time driver for AlphaTauri. Like, I just think that's the right thing you do. And it's not like their obligations to Sergio Perez are huge financially. It's a one-year contract that they'll pay out and send him on his way. I just think that's probably the right thing to do. And this is where it benefits you as Red Bull to have a second team in the premier class of global motorsports in AlphaTauri that they can have these conversations. But I just think it's so logical that it's going to be Daniel Ricciardo. Now, maybe he falls off a cliff and they haven't made a decision and Sergio Perez runs off three straight race wins, but I don't see that happening. And even if it did, I just think they've seen enough from both drivers to have made their decision.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even see Max like lifting at all. I mean, he's certainly...
He's won 50 of 16. He's always... He'll win all three, yeah, man.
I mean, I just don't think he's programmed to ease up like ever. I mean, regardless of the fact that Red Bull are constructors champions, regardless of the fact that he's world champion again, I think that all Max knows how to do is get into a racing car, give it 110%, go out there, win races. I just don't think that you know, I don't think he's has that like mentality that he's just going to phone it in. It's just like, well, that's not what I'm getting paid to do. My job is to go win races. Like, who cares if I'm already world champion? I'm supposed to win races. Let's go win another race. Because, you know, like going back to that graphic that you had last week, you know, that sort of that spoked diagram with all the different race wins and things like that. I mean, when you look at all the dates on that and how many race wins that this guy has racked up, especially the last couple of years, it is absolutely phenomenal. And, I just don't see it. Like, especially like, so his teammate can win one. Like, you know, out of everyone, I would be like, well, if Max, I would think, would be of the attitude, well, if Sergio thinks he can beat me, then let him come out here and beat me. Like, all he has to do is drive faster than me and he'll win. Kind of thing. I think with Max, it's really that binary, right? It's just like, you know, there isn't too much to it. I don't think he would be wrong. I mean, it's just like, I'd probably be the same way. If somebody thinks they're better than me, then come out and prove it, you know? It's either, deliver the goods or don't. Anyways, we spent a lot of time talking about that. Let's talk now about Aston Martin. Mark, this is a team that you and I have been so excited about for the last couple of years, and they've shown some flashes, and they get us excited because there's obviously the big Canadian connection there with the Strolls and all the money that they've invested in the team. It's a classic brand that everybody loves, and we've been really excited to see that. That's why it was so much fun to watch the beginning of the year. And I just remember, like, back in Miami, you know, happy Fernando joking, you know, with Danica Patrick in the interviews of like, this is like a side to Fernando Alonso that we've like probably never seen ever in the history of Formula One. He looked like he was so happy and it looked like it was such a good place. He was enjoying stuff, but over the course of the season, obviously that second best car to Red Bull, they were better than Ferrari, better than Mercedes, but they've all improved and passed them. So I mean, they lost out that second place to Mercedes, then to Ferrari, now to Aston Martin. They're not going to drop down any further in the constructors, but if you look the teams that are behind them, I think it truly has to be embarrassing to where they are right now for them as an organization compared to where they started from. But there's a reason to that. Let's dive into that a little bit deeper, Mark.
Yeah, I think the good news is they're going to get this sorted out. That it's an interesting topic to speak to, simply because, to your point, they were so, and I should be cautious when I say that It's not they. Fernando Alonso was spectacular to begin the season and put in some exceptional drives and scored some exceptional results. But I think regardless of where they are now, and I think it probably feels like they're in the cavern or the abyss, and it's probably very, it feels probably hopeless, and they're clawing desperately to get out of it. But ultimately, I think at some point during the season, they broke this car conceptually, and I don't think they understand what they broke. And I think every time they feel that they've got an upgrade that's going to fix the problem, it doesn't work. And then they're scrambling to try to undo and reverse the work that they've just done to get back to where they were when they were successful. And, you know, Dan Fallows, who was, of course, head of aerodynamics at Red Bull, came over. And I think early in the season, there was a lot of speculation that he had brought with him some of the fundamental aerodynamic concepts that had made Red Bull successful. And I think they'd applied them to the car to great effect early in the season. And I think that the general belief within the paddock was that while that concept worked, they didn't know how to improve upon it. That, hey, look, we've copied the homework, but we didn't really understand the formula and the equation that got us there. And as they tried to iterate and improve upon that concept, they ultimately took it in the wrong direction and they broke it. And Mike Crack's spoken about this at length. But I don't think they're in a good place yet. And it's also not clear to us yet whether, hey, they've really abandoned this car. I know they continue to iterate and bring some upgrades as they try to level out the performance, but I think they probably fundamentally shift their focus to next year's car, the next iteration of the AMR. And I think that's probably where their money and their focus should be in a cost cap era. But yeah, it's really fascinating that this car could look so good. And I know you and I, because it was so clear at the beginning of the year that Red Bull was going to romp to the championship and they were going to dominate. But the sexy topic for us was that, wow, Fernando Alonso, suddenly this fun, charismatic dude, and he's suddenly very likable. And all of a sudden, Aston Martin, the team that you and I had gotten behind in a big way in 21 and 22, they're scoring podiums and they look like they could win a race this year. And I know earlier this year, you and I weren't even having a conversation about how likely is it that they could win a race. And of course, there's nothing farther from viability right now than them winning a race, but they fundamentally broke the car. But I think back to my initial point, the good news is they have a very committed, invested owner that's pumped a ton of money into this car. And I know about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, that there was a lot of speculation that this team was possibly being positioned for sale to a Saudi-based organization, and that Saudi Aramco, who's of course one of their major sponsors, was helping to broker that deal. That hasn't come to fruition, and maybe it still does. And even if it does, I think that Lawrence Stroll has taken several years to build some really great infrastructure at Silverstone to set this team up for success. So obviously the second half of the season has been a huge disappointment. And I think Lance Stroll has been exceptionally disappointing throughout the season. And we've kind of had that conversation ad nauseum. But I think that Fernando Alonso is still the right driver for this team. And I think if they can come back with a better car next year that kind of builds on the successes that they had early in the season from an aerodynamic perspective and doesn't have the failings that this car has developed and inherited as the season went on, they'll be in a really good place. But I'm not super worried. I'm disappointed because they look so good and it was spicing up the championship, but I suspect they'll come back with a really strong contender next year.
Oh, let's hope so, because they certainly at the beginning of the year when they were doing so much better, like it was just one of those feel good stories that, yeah, it looks like Max is going to walk this one this year and Red Bull's going to win the Constructors' Championship. I thought it was such a good story that you have this team that has its genesis in a very small operation. And then, like you say, you get like this committed owner that comes in, dumps a ton of money into the team. They've got this brand new factory, this brand new facility that they're going to move into. They're hiring, they're expanding their workforce, and then sadly, as the season has gone on, they've dropped down through the order, and I guess it is what it is. But hopefully, at some point, all that investment and all not just in hardware and facilities and things like that, but also the money that they've invested in people and bringing those people to the team will pay off as well, and that they'll be able to design a winner. Because I was getting used to happy Fernando, because I've had a bit of a love-hate relationship with him over the course of his Formula One career. It's been more on the hate side, but I found something quite what's the proper word? Attractive about happy Fernando is like, you know, he looks like he's in a good place. He's driving good. He's getting results. I feel like I want to cheer for him, which is at odds with the way that I felt about him at the time with McLaren and Ferrari and everything else. But however it is what it is. Okay, next story. This is an interesting one. I'll let you talk about this one. But Petronas is, they've acquired the naming rights to the Sepang circuit, which is where we've had the Malaysian Grand Prix. We haven't had it for a couple of years because it fell off of the calendar. But Petronas is a big name, big company with very deep pockets. Do you get the feeling, Mark, that we're going to see a return to Formula One at Sepang, or is this just kind of a small thing, or do you think that maybe Petronas is trying to pump some money into that facility so the owners can try and attract Formula One back? What's your take? I know this is you're kind of in your wheelhouse.
I think that's a really good question. And I think the unfortunate reality is a lot of our listeners never had the opportunity to see a live Grand Prix from Sepang. And boy, was that a great circuit. And for those of you that don't know, the Sepang International Circuit, which I guess has now been renamed, sits immediately adjacent to the Kuala Lumpur International Airport. It sits on the outskirts of Kuala Lumpur, and it was a phenomenal track. It was great for MotoGP, and it was great for Formula One. And for many years, it hosted both Formula One and MotoGP. But in the country of Malaysia, motorcycle racing is king, and the MotoGP events at this circuit sell out and they draw huge crowds. And I think over the years, it became tougher and tougher and tougher to sell the F1 ticket or the volume of tickets to an F1 race to make it viable. And the bigger challenge too is by car, the Sepang circuit is only 3 hours from Singapore. It's like 311 kilometers. It's not far. And I think the challenge was you had two races that were effectively cannibalizing each other. They were cannibalizing each other from a sponsorship perspective, and they were also cannibalizing each other from a ticket sales perspective. And I don't think it was really going to be viable. And I think if it was going to happen, maybe we could have seen something during the COVID period. But I think ultimately this was a country that was very cautious and conservative when it came to managing the COVID pandemic. But I don't think there's any likelihood. I mean, anything's possible. I just don't think that this is going to happen. Of course, Petronas is also very much involved in the motorcycle racing world, and they have sponsorships on a ton of bikes. And I think this probably reflects that. And I think it probably also reflects the fact that the rights were available for a song, and Petronas being a kind of a Malaysian based entity probably got a really good deal. And I think it was probably also just the right thing to do from a national perspective. But I don't think it means that Formula One's going to return here. But if you are interested and you've got the F1 TV Pro app, I highly recommend you go back and check out some of the races from this circuit, because there were some absolute bangers there in the dry, in the wet. It was always an exciting race. But unfortunately, I don't think we're going back to Sepang anytime soon.
Well, if we were, then something else would have to fall off the calendar somewhere.
Exactly, man.
I'm still not convinced that we're going to go to Shanghai next year for the Chinese Grand Prix, but I'm feeling it a little bit more than, say, like the past couple of years when, you know, during COVID and then coming out of COVID. But the fact that they're on the schedule for next year, I get the feeling that China's going to happen again at some point. And I guess too, it would also depend on who and where and when, because, you know, they're trying to get these kind of like regional blocks of races, that if something kind of fell off the middle of the schedule, could you rearrange everything to kind of keep everybody in the Eastern Hemisphere for those first couple of races? So it's not necessarily a slam dunk. I mean, you'll see, if China fell off the calendar, then maybe sure, because regionally and geographically speaking, they're going to be in that geographic part of the world to start the season. But like I say, I get the feeling that's going to happen again next year, but never say never. But as you say, there were some absolutely amazing races there over the years. Okay, next story here comes from Ian Parks over speedcafe.com, and it's entitled FIA President Explains 1 Million Euro Driver's Fine, and where he sat down, spoke with Mohammed Ben Sulaim, the president of the FIA. So the backstory to this is that the world's motor, or the governing body, the FIA, recently decided to raise the maximum fine that it could impose on a Formula One driver, and that is 1 million euros, which is a very, very, very large amount of money. And it's basically a 300% increase, because previously the maximum fine was 250,000 euros, which is also a serious chunk of cash. And you know, for a lot of the drivers in Formula One, if they got hit with that €1 million fine, that would be actually more than the salary that they earned an entire year. Anyways, so Bin Sulayem explained this to Speed Cafe by saying the following quote: "The price of everything has gone up. The teams are now talking about billions of terms of what each team is worth, and we've still not improved our regulations dating back to Jurassic Park. We are not saying go and pay. We are saying don't make these unnecessary penalties. If you don't do it, you won't get it. Nobody will impose something on you if you follow the rules. The rules are there to be policed and to be implemented." End quote. So he didn't actually, you know, specify exactly what you'd have to do to get like a 1 million euro fine. He did say to the reporter, quote, "Stick to the rules and nobody will say anything. Nobody will charge you with anything. People are over exaggerating about this. And if anyone is penalized, where does the money go? To grassroots motorsports, investment back into the sport. I hope they can make life easier for our stewards by sticking to the rules instead of misbehaving. We obviously don't want them to reach that $1 million euro, so we're saying don't do it. The rules are there. They're transparent. We have nothing to hide. But I cannot tell you why the $1 million would be, or $1 million would be implemented. That's for the stewards, not for the presidents. The stewards are there. They are experienced. They know what to do. And the drivers, they are very intelligent. They know about the rules before they jump into the car." End quote. So I don't know. Seems like it'd have to be a pretty egregious thing to do if you're going to get like smacked with a 1 million euro fine. But it's funny that they would raise it from 250 to a million and then not even give you sort of like a conceptual framework of, you know, when that fine might be implemented.
Daly, you just nailed it, right? Like, you know what? Maybe we could be okay, because it's not going to be us that's paying it anyways, dude. We're just spectators watching, but we're certainly going to talk about it when and if it happens, and hopefully it doesn't. But I think that point you make about not providing a conceptual framework is the problem here, right? That you ultimately need to be able to provide tiers that, look, if you commit an infraction on the track, let's say Michael Schumacher, 1997 at Jerez, when he tries to intentionally knock Jacques Villeneuve out of the race by driving into the side of him. Like, to me, that is $1 million fine. You intentionally crashed into another car. He was disqualified, but to me, that's like top
and
tier.
And banned for the rest of the season,
totally. Like, that's a top tier million euro fine. Just be crystal clear about that. And then maybe the second tier would be, you know what, intentionally causing a crash to alter the outcome of a race, as we saw at Singapore.
Crash gate.
Exactly. Like, set those, like, provide some conceptual framework, because if you leave it to the FIA, you know what, one person's interpretation of a million euro fine could be very different. And based on who's adjudicating the incident, the outcome could be very, very different. And you're right, like, €1 million, like, for Lewis, for Max, like, $1 million is nothing. €1 million is nothing. But for some of these drivers, man, especially outside of the Formula One ranks, like, €1 million is an unfathomably huge amount of money. I just agree with you that, hey, look, you're the FIA and you like to write rules. You know what? Just build a conceptual framework that we can all look at to understand when and how these fines would be applied.
Yeah, I mean, if they're transparent, then, you know, we could get a copy of it. But I mean, there has to be some sort of like policy around it. I mean, otherwise it could be applied arbitrarily, like you say, like any random steward, you know, could rally for something and say we need to impose this fine. But yeah, I mean, that those couple of examples that you gave, I think are ideal and would be right at the top of you know the fine list there. But yeah, you know, Crashgate, the whole Schumacher thing, you know, that Schumacher
Villeneuve thing, that's 25 years ago now. We just passed the anniversary, I think, just to the last two to
Dude,
3 weeks.
Dude, 26 years ago.
Is it 26? Yeah. Oh my God, even worse. I thought it was 25, but when you're talking quarter century time frames, years not really here nor there anymore, is it? All right, moving along to the next story here. Got a couple more before we get into the race preview. So Valentino Rossi, according to the legendary motorbike racer, he said that he would be very enthusiastic to support Andrea Kimi Antonelli's pursuit of Formula One, but he doesn't want to commit, expanding his VR46 rider academy to a four-wheeled competition. So this is a nice crossover. It's got Rossi, who is my favorite, motorcycle rider of all time. You're a big MotoGP guy. You got a nice crossover here. So I'm not going to ramble. I'll let you take this one over, Mark.
Interesting story. And it occurred to me as I was reading this article, because Valentino Rossi is commenting, by the way, I don't know if people realize this, but Valentino Rossi actually got his start in karting as well, as I think a lot of young motorsports enthusiasts
really?
Do, but he made the switch to two-wheel, and again, the world was better for it because he was the most transcendent motorcycle rider in the history of the planet. But it's interesting because he makes kind of a comment about the fact that this young up-and-coming driver in Andrea Kimi Antonelli could potentially be the next Italian driver. And of course, there isn't an Italian driver in Formula One right now. And it's remarkable because we look at Formula One over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, that we've had races at Monza and we've had races at Mugello, and we've had races like we've had three different races. There's two Italian races on the calendar right now, and you have an Italian-based team in Ferrari, but we don't have an Italian-based driver. And it's funny because I went and looked this up on Wikipedia. I'm like, when was the last time an Italian-born driver won a Formula One World Championship? And Alberto Ascari, who raced from 50 to 55, he won two titles, one in 52 and one in 53. And then Nino Farina raced from 50 to 56, and he won a title in 1950. That no Italian driver. We talk about how important it is to Italian motorsports fans that Ferrari is successful, but you know what? Compartmentalize them as a team right now. We haven't had an Italian-born driver win a title in almost, 70 years this year, which is remarkable. And of course, there's been some flourishes. And I'll bring up some of the more active recent drivers. Obviously, Antonio Giovinazzi, who is in a lot of ways just a really glorified reserve driver. We had Bruni, we had Pantano, we had Trulli, we had Fisichella. And really, none of these kind of strike as a transcendent superstar that was capable of winning Formula One Grand Prix. And of course, Trulli, I think, competed in 250 races or something. If Fisichella competed in 231, but they weren't out there necessarily winning Grand Prix consistently. I think combined, those two drivers that I just mentioned had four wins and maybe 30 podiums or something like that. But we haven't had somebody that could meaningfully contend for a world championship. So I thought that was interesting, and maybe that's going to change. But I think it would rock the Formula One world if you had an Italian driver, forget Ferrari, but an Italian driver competing for a championship. The other kind of takeaway from here is that I think, as most people know, Valentino Rossi, when he was still competing in the top tier of motorcycle racing and MotoGP, he started an academy called VR46, and 46 was the number he raced under. VR stands for Valentino Rossi, and originally had a team in Moto3 and then Moto2, and then he wrapped up both of those teams and jumped into MotoGP. And last year, the championship rider was a graduate of the VR46 Academy and Francesco Bagnaia. And this year, Bagnaia looks to be again contending, or is currently sitting in first place and will likely win this year's MotoGP championship as well. That his VR46 Academy has been wildly successful, both in terms of developing Italian riders that have been successful in MotoGP, but now he has a team in VR46 Racing that is wildly successful in winning races. So for instance, if I bring up this current standings right now, let's take a look here. So right now, if you look at the team standings, Prima Pramac Racing is currently sitting in number one. That's a Ducati-based team. They're sitting in the first spot with 570 points. Moody VR46 Racing, which is really in its infancy, they're number two in the team's championship right now with 474 points, and they have three race wins this year, which is just remarkable. So it just seems that whatever Valentino Rossi touches turns to gold. The other thing he commented on in this article on formulascout.com, which you and I are referencing here, is that while it's not imminent, he is open to the idea of the VR46 Academy potentially getting into four-wheel racing. Now, I would caution that that's probably not a good use of resources because it's incredibly expensive and there's already so many institutions and academies in that world. But if he's truly committed to helping an young Italian driver be successful in F1, there's worse people that could be doing it than VR46 and Valentino Rossi.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about other legends, Lewis Hamilton says that Mercedes can build a great car, but I heard Red Bull are progressing. This is an article on Crash.net written by Lewis Larkham. So I'll just pull up the exact quote here. So Lewis, what he was just talking about, the progress and improvement that we've seen from Mercedes in recent times, which was centered around the introduction of a new floor, and it's given Lewis a new boost of confidence. He had the following to say, quotes, "I'm incredibly proud of my team. I have total faith in them. I know we can build a great car. We haven't for the past 2 years, but we can build a great car. There are a lot of engineers. Nobody wants to copy anybody, but they want to find their own way. But I think we are progressing. But I've heard that Red Bull are progressing as well. So we have to be really, really strategic and really clinical. They know that already. In order for us to be battling those guys, they're also quick on the straights. We are losing 2.5 tenths into turn one, but I believe I'm ready. If we could get the car that can match them, we're going to have some great battles next year." End quote. So, that seems like a typical Lewis, enthusiastic response. But it's kind of funny when you think about it that It seems like an awfully short amount of time that we've gone from them being like the dominant team in Formula One to being still in the top three, but not necessarily.
Can I share something else with you that I heard recently?
And sure.
This is just kind of gossipy, rumory nonsense. But obviously, Lewis has looked. Put aside the unforced error in Qatar, and put aside the disqualification in Coda, which obviously was not a byproduct of his driving style or anything that he had done. He's been very good this year, and he's had some strong P2 finishes, and he could, in different realities, be sitting comfortably in P2, and he might still finish the year in P2, but he's looked exceptional, and he's clearly been the second best driver in the entire world of Formula One, which is remarkable for a driver like him, especially considering his age, and especially considering the fact that I don't think anyone at Brackley or Brixworth would argue that this car is what it should be based on the money they poured into it. But he's been remarkable. But the thing that I'd heard recently was this, that last year, we all know that George Russell finished ahead of Lewis Hamilton in the Drivers' Championship. And obviously, he had some remarkable finishes, and he had all those top five finishes at the beginning of the year when the car looked really poor. And there was a lot of conversations about, hey, is Lewis Hamilton like mentally hungover after the fallout from Abu Dhabi and all those kind of things. But somebody had shared something with me recently, and I don't want to share the contact, but they had spoken to the fact that last year, George Russell and Lewis Hamilton had two very different missions in that season, and that George Russell, having made the move finally from Williams to the Mercedes team, was out there for George Russell, that he was going out weekend in, weekend out, and trying to score as many points as he could. And that as a result, he was being quite successful relative to his teammate. And that Lewis Hamilton alternatively realized that the car was fundamentally broken, and he was willing to be the guinea pig for Mercedes last year, meaning that he was willing to sacrifice personal performances to help the team dial in and better understand the car that they were working with, knowing that in the short term, my results might suffer, but in the long term, in 22, 23, if I'm willing to help the team experiment and give them tons of feedback, that maybe we can build a contender in 23 and potentially 24. And that might have been the reason there was such a discrepancy between the two of them last year, and why all of a sudden those results have flipped. That all of a sudden this year, it's a kind of a mirror of what we saw last year, which is Lewis comfortably ahead of George Russell and significantly outperforming him both in qualifying pace, in race pace, in driving style, certainly not making the mistakes minus Qatar that his teammate is, that Lewis is clearly demonstrating to the world that he's still a better racing car driver, but it made sense to me. And certainly Toto Wolff hasn't come out and acknowledged this, and George Russell hasn't, and I don't think Lewis Hamilton ever will. He's got far too much class to kind of throw his teammate under the bus. But I thought that was very, very interesting. And if true, it just speaks to what a remarkable character Lewis is, that, look, you know what? A P4, a P5 is meaningless if it means that I'm only going to score P4 and 5s next year. Let's do what's necessary. Let's do the dirty work this year to put this car in a better place in 23 and 24.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point and an interesting thing to talk about, right? And I just couldn't help but think too when you were just going over that list of reasons and talking about that. The one thing that popped into my mind immediately was like, well, if Lewis potentially took all this time to work with the team and give them feedback on how to improve the car, you know, he was being obviously very specific. You know, we have to do this, this, and this. And once those improvements came on the car, you know, might have been sort of like expecting them rather than, say, George taking the car and just trying to wrestle it around and extract everything he could, he could get out of it, where Lewis could be a little bit more, I don't know, targeted, a little bit more strategic around those changes. So that would be very, very interesting, if that was indeed the case. But I mean, there hasn't been really any talk about like Lewis v. George this year. I mean, Lewis is where he is, just on the body of his work to date, and just being very consistent and being very quick as usual, whereas George has struggled a little bit at time to time, relatively speaking. Okay, let's take one final break here. We'll come back and we'll start previewing the Brazilian Grand Prix. I had a note up here from the British Grand Prix. I almost said British Grand Prix instead of Brazilian Grand Prix, but we're moving ahead. We're not going into the past. We'll wait till Silverstone next year, which is always a highlight. But until then, let's just take a quick time out. We'll come back on the flip side. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the show. A couple more things to go. This next news story comes from 8newsnow.com, written by Ryan Mathey. It's titled, "Is F1 Worth It? Clark County Leader Weighs Disruptions, Promise of $1.3 billion Economic Benefit." So this is quite something. Of course, we have the inaugural Las Vegas Grand Prix coming up, and there's a couple interesting quotes in this article from Ryan Mathey. So it sort of starts off saying here, Clark County Commission Chair Jim Gibson acknowledged that there was a ticking timeline for the Las Vegas Grand Prix from the start. So then the first question that was asked by Politics Now anchor John Langler, and the question was, did it happen too quickly? And then Gibson responded, quotes, "By any standard, it happened way too quickly. Once we got into it, it was obvious the race was going to be a real challenge for us and for the entire community." So that's interesting, right? So when asked about other things about the Las Vegas Grand Prix, Gibson went on to say, quote, "It's okay with us. At the end of the day, Formula One has made a commitment. They didn't pack up and leave when we said we're going to pause this. They understand this race is bigger than all of us. It's bigger than they are," end quote. But he goes on to say, "This is a benefit to all of us, so it has not been a sacrifice, a lot of sacrifice, but not all. I think we have a couple of years to level out. This year has been very disruptive," end quote. So a couple little tiny nuggets. Mark, what is your takeaway from these admissions from the Clark County Chair?
I find it fascinating, right, that it's such a unique city. It's a city of, I think the metro population is like 2.5 million people now. It's growing exponentially, and I think there's a lot of people migrating over from the Pacific Northwest and from California. But this is a city that also in recent years has become a big league town, right? That they had that expansion NHL yes. team in 2017, and then the Oakland Raiders moved. Of course, they're very much a candidate for the next round of NBA expansion. Of course, they got a WNBA team, I think in 2018 when the Aces moved to town. They opened a brand new arena in T-Mobile. They opened the brand new NFL stadium in Allegiant. They opened the brand new Michelob Ultra Arena, which is where the WNBA team plays. If an NBA team comes, they're going to get a new stadium as well. And then, of course, John Fisher, who's the owner of the Oakland Athletics, the Major League Baseball team, he's in kind of final deep negotiations to move his ball club there. So Major League Baseball is going to set up shop there. Now, that one is super controversial because it's going to extract a ton of money from Clark County to fund that ballpark. And I think there's a lot of opposition to that. But on top of all of this, and of course, this is a unique city because its entire premise is based on being a tourist destination, and you need mechanisms to draw and attract people to come to that city and spend their money. And I think big league sports is a great way of doing that. I think F1's a little bit different because you know what? You build Allegiant Stadium and you know there's going to be some traffic around that stadium 8 days a week or 8 Sundays a year. But F1, it really compromises the accessibility to the city center for weeks or maybe a month or two prior to a Grand Prix where they've got to set up and tear down. Now, some of, I think, the friction and pain that local residents have felt recently are kind of one-timers that, hey, they need to build the infrastructure and there's a lot of construction. They need to resurface the roads and, hey, you're not going to have to do that every single year. But it's going to be interesting to see how receptive the local community is to this race, right? Like global motorsports fans are going to embrace it, especially if it makes for good racing. But there's also people in the city that have to live with the inconvenience. And in Singapore, I think they've learned to adjust. In Monaco, it's just been the way of life for 7 decades, for maybe 2 generations now. But this is something that people in Las Vegas are going to have to learn to live with. And I'm still very much suspect of the potential economic impact that if interest in F1 falls off, then you know what, you've committed to the city in a big way as Formula One because you've built all this super expensive infrastructure and you've committed to going there for 10 years at minimum. That's a little bit risky. But again, it's also not like COTA where you attract 450,000 people over a 3-day race weekend, that attendance is going to be much slimmer. Now, the ASP or the average sales price of your tickets is going to be much higher. But again, it's fewer people spending presumably less money than 450,000 people. And where's that money going to go? Is it going to go into existing businesses like existing hotels and restaurants? Well, were they going to be full already? And is there potentially an opportunity cost here? Like how much incremental income is this going to generate for the city? And from an exposure perspective, if you're Baku or you're Singapore, hosting a Grand Prix is really great because you get to promote your city to a global audience that probably isn't super familiar with it. Dude, everyone knows Las Vegas. Like you got to think Las Vegas is basically at the saturation point now. Like, is this going to attract additional visitors outside of the race weekend? I don't know. Like, I'm still excited to see what it looks like. I hope it's going to be successful because I think it's good for all of us in North America and for North American motorsports fans. And in turn, it's going to be great for F1. I'm very suspicious about what the community benefits of this race are going to be.
Yeah, it's funny too. Like you made like a couple of interesting comments there. The first one, you're saying that that there's 2.5 billion people in the metro Las Vegas area, and it's funny because I was thinking about it. It's like I've met and know so many people from literally every single corner of the USA, but I don't know a single person who said that, hey, I'm from Vegas. I know literally. Practically everyone I know has gone to Vegas as a visitor, but I've never met like actually someone that's from Vegas. So, I mean, obviously that city is changing. There's it's growing all the time. So it's interesting because I always got this this impression probably incorrectly that it was always this smaller type city, this destination as a this gambling resort, whatever it is, and all the fun things that you can do in Vegas. But it's really changed. I mean, to me, like in the last several years, it has more of that big league feel to it, because before, like you say, they never had like anything. All they had before was like the UNLV running Rebels, the big sports game in town. But they have the Golden Knights now, the Las Vegas Raiders, and some of these other ones you were talking about. It's got like a very, very different feel to it. It's always glitzy and glamour, but now it seems like the city as a general is starting to mature a little bit and kind of branching out into different things that would, I guess, previously could be considered like very un-Las Vegas like. So it's just I work in that sort of a profession of like land development and planning and things like that. So from a professional point of view, I find it fascinating to watch the city evolve. But also, like you say, like Formula One is committed to them in a big time way, like this 10-year commitment and pouring in tons of money and things like that. I mean, there's obviously going to be some hiccups and little speed bumps, especially at the beginning here, and who knows where it'll go in the long run. There are obviously some risks, but they must think that the potential reward for it outweighs like any risk that there could be. So we'll have to, you know, revisit this periodically over the years, Mark, before we can make the final call on that. So finally, you know, before we pull out the plug here and call it another night, we have the Brazilian Grand Prix this weekend going, you know, at its usual place at Autodromo José Carlos Pace. Anyways, Interlagos in Brazil and Sao Paulo. It's a classic track. It's an older school Formula One track. It's a little narrow in places. It's twisty. Interlagos speeds between two lakes. Very, very scenic location for the track itself. And last year, we had a sprint weekend there. We have a sprint weekend there this year. So the first time we saw the Brazilian Grand Prix being held was back in 1972. The most wins for a driver is Alain Prost, who won there six times over the course of his very illustrious Formula One career. The most wins for a constructor is McLaren, who has won 12. So last year, we had Kevin Magnussen on pole for this one. That was quite a memorable event when K-Mag took pole. So he set a pole time of 111.674. The podium was George Russell, Lewis Hamilton, and Carlos Sainz. George Russell setting the fastest lap of a 113.785. So some of the most winningest drivers, in addition to Alain Prost, Carlos Reutemann and Michael Schumacher, won four apiece. Sebastian Vettel, Lewis Hamilton have three wins apiece. And then there's a whole bunch of drivers, including Emerson Fittipaldi, Nelson Piquet, Nigel Mansell, the great Ayrton Senna, Mika Hakkinen, Felipe Massa, Mark Webber, Nico Rosberg have all two wins apiece. Like I said, McLaren have 12 wins. Ferrari have 11 wins there. Williams and Mercedes have six wins apiece, so some big-time winners there. And Red Bull have already scored four race victories at Interlagos. Mark, we were talking this before we went on to air this this evening. It's a sprint weekend, and we didn't really get a chance to talk about this too much. So here we go again. This time last year, the Brazilian Grand Prix, or the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, as it's more you know, properly known. I'm living in the past here. The sprint weekend format worked. It was pretty exciting. It was a great weekend, obviously for George Russell, who won the sprint race and then also won the Grand Prix itself. And not only that, but we had a two Mercedes on the podium with George and Lewis Hamilton. Then you had two Ferraris, and then you had Fernando Alonso in the Alpine, and then you didn't have Max and Sergio in the top five. The two Red Bulls, you know, came home in sixth and seventh, but you know, at that point, Max had already you know, wrapped up the championship, and I guess. You know, apart from, you know, the phenomenal weekend that George Russell had 1 year ago, this is when, you know, Max kind of put Sergio at his place. And, you know, there was that kind of like tense, you know, conversation between Max and his engineer. But let's just talk about it quickly, Mark. Despite what happened last year in the sprint format at Sao Paulo, is this something we're looking forward to? Because I'm kind of sort of not really too excited, but I'm hoping that because I'm not very excited about it, that they're going to over deliver. Well, I'm not really expecting too much. What do you think of that?
I totally appreciate it. And you know what? Obviously, I'm not super thrilled about the sprint race weekend format. And I think my perception or my enjoyment of them would be very different if there was something on stake. At this point, it's just more of the same, which is just really Red Bull just kind of running roughshod over the rest of the competition. But if there's going to be a sprint race weekend anywhere, it might as well be at Interlagos, because this is unquestionably one of the very best circuits on the entire planet. It runs anti-clockwise, which makes it unique. It's carved out of the side of a hill. It has, I think, five left-handed turns and nine right-handed turns, although I could have that in reverse. It's an incredibly, incredibly exciting track. It's got a combination of slow and medium speed corners. Teams typically go in with a high downforce setup. It's just an exceptional exceptional place to watch a Grand Prix. Like you said, it's pretty narrow. Your mistakes are typically penalized. We're going to see Pirelli bring out kind of the medium range, the C2s, the C3s, the C4s, ultimately. But it's just one of the very best circuits on the calendar. It's also one of the shortest, I think, after Mexico and Monaco. But ultimately, it's just one of the very best places to see a Formula One Grand Prix. Now, I don't know what it's like to see it in person. I think I understand the neighborhood and the community around it. Is it especially safe? But in terms of putting on a Formula One Grand Prix in a spectacle, it's one of the very best. And there was a real significant risk that Interlagos was going to drop off the calendar a couple of years ago because there was a competing developer in another Brazilian city that wanted to wrestle the Brazilian Grand Prix away. And I think under Bernie, it seemed like that was a certainty. But fortunately, that Grand Prix circuit didn't get off the ground. And I don't think they ever kind of broke ground or kind of bowled out the bulldozers. But I think we're very lucky that Interlagos, despite everything that's happened with respect to Formula One, continues to be on the calendar. And I think this is going to be the 40th time that we've raced at this track. And I think, like you suggested a couple of minutes ago, Ferrari's won here 10 times. So they've been very successful. Again, I have every reason to suspect that Red Bull will be very successful this weekend. But if we're going to have a sprint race weekend anywhere, it might as well be on a track that is very, very, very fun to watch. And just to kind of correct my previous comment a couple of minutes ago, 5 right-handers and 9 left-handers with a ton of directional changes.
Yeah, I was just taking a look here at the weather mark on Sunday afternoon or Saturday. It's going to be we're going to have highs of 28 Celsius or 82 Fahrenheit, 14 degrees for a low. So that's in the mid 50s. Then on Sunday, going to be a little bit cooler. We're looking at Sunday afternoon, high of 22 degrees Celsius, same low for 14 degrees, and so that's low 70s of Fahrenheit. You know, importantly, at least at the moment, it looks like the weather's going to be a little bit sunny on Saturday afternoon, so we'll have to wait and see whether or not that pans out. But at least it looks like the weather's going to be decent. Like you mentioned here, it's a bit of a shorter lap. The lap records or the fastest lap last year was set by George Russell. It's a 113.785. The length of the course is it's not very long. It's only 2.68 miles or 4.31 kilometers, 71 laps, a total race distance of 305.88 kilometers or 190.06 miles. So there you go, right there. Not the longest one, but you know, 113. You know, still get a decent amount of laps in there. So the race lap records there was set by Valtteri Bottas in 2018 for Mercedes, and his time was a 118.540. If you look at last year's fastest lap time, said like George Russell, his fastest lap time was 113.78 time. Kevin Magnussen's pole time was 111.674. So who knows whether or not they can get close to Valtteri's lap record time, but it seems a little bit improbable. We'll wait and see. Anyways, Mark, I guess, do we call it the way that we've been calling every other race this year that Max is going to win this one? Yeah, I feel like we're just going to do that. You know, and I hate to be so negative, but I've kind of come to the point now that, especially the last couple of weeks, I'm like, I'm just so done with this. Let's just go into the off season and come back for for March. But you know, that's what happens when you have the season that wrapped up so early. But hey, Mark, breaking news! Just as we're talking here, just got a notification on my phone. The Texas Rangers have won the World Series.
Congratulations to everyone in the Dallas Fort Worth Frisco metro area. Congratulations to everyone in Dallas on your first World Series championship.
That's incredible. And wasn't it just like a couple of years ago they lost over 100 games or something like that? So what a turnaround to go from such a low point to winning a World Series. That is absolutely incredible. I can't wait to see the pictures tomorrow. Like, I remember a couple of years ago when Kansas City won the World Series and see like all these huge crowds out celebrating and things like that.
And I'm sure that they're gonna go nuts. It continues the string of Texas Major League Baseball dominance because the cheaters, and I will call them that. The Houston Astros, of course, had a very successful run over the last few seasons and have consistently made it to the, I still can't get my head around the fact that the Houston Astros are in the American League, but they made a number of pennants. But yeah, like if you look at the World Series results over the last couple of years, let's take a look here. So obviously this year, the Texas Rangers won. Last year it was Houston. The year before, Houston lost in the World Series. Houston lost in 2019. They won in 2017. So a lot of Texas representation. So this is the third Texas team to win a World Series title since 2017. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, but before we just wrap it up, like you're more than just like a mere baseball fan. Like you had the opportunity, like there was, why did you just tell everyone your story?
Yeah, so I don't talk a lot about this, but when I was in high school, I was a very, very competitive baseball player. And I thought at one point there was a very strong possibility that I would have become part of the Oakland Athletics system. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. And at the time, I couldn't get a full ride scholarship to a US school, which is where you needed to go to be able to kind of advance your skill set at that point. And the idea of kind of paying out of pocket as an international student just wasn't worth it. But of course, let's be realistic, I was never going to play Major League Baseball, but there was an opportunity where I could have extended my baseball career by another couple of years. And of course, in hindsight, you always look back like, yeah, I wonder what if, but baseball is a sport I'm very passionate about. But that said, I think in a lot of ways I've kind of fallen out of love with it. Although I think they've done some really great things this year with the pitch clock and things like that. Like they've sped up the game kind of incredibly, and my son loves it. So maybe I'll get more into it, but basketball has become kind of my first love as far as team sports are concerned, but I'll always have a very soft spot for baseball.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to wrap it up. Thank you, one and all, for tuning in this evening. Tuning in, I guess that's a little bit kind of, I've just exposed myself for the old person that I am. Thank you for downloading and listening to the show. If you want to get in touch, send us an email, scooteryf1pod@gmail.com, or give us a follow on X. Still haven't made a call yet on what we're going to do with our social media, but for the time being, at least slide into our DM, say, hello at Scooter F1 Pod, and that's a wrap for us. You can also do us a favor, head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Leave us a 5-star rating and review if you enjoyed the show. Share it with a friend, all that good stuff. And Mark and I would be extremely grateful because that's the easiest way you could support us and what we do here. And there's no cost to it other than just a few moments of your time, which we know everybody is so super busy these days, and that's why it means all the very well. So much to us. Anyhow, we'll leave it there. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. Enjoy the race this weekend, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday night. So we'll talk to you then. Take care. Bye for now.